An important point of this whole symposium is to give props to Jay McClellan and sort of demonstrate ways in which his research and him as a person has influenced a number of careers and a number of research programs. And that's stuff that I don't want to skip that part of this talk. And so it goes back for me to 1989 when I took a neural networks course as a junior at UC Santa Cruz. And the instructor for that course was Alan Kawamoto. We used the PDP books. They were only a few years old at that time. We used the PDP software. And as it turns out, Alan Kawamoto had been a postdoc with Jay McClellan only a few years before that. He was part of the PDP research group. That's where I learned it, only one degree of freedom away from one of the major sources. And now I teach a neural networks course these days where I have juniors and seniors learn MATLAB, and they build their neural networks from scratch in MATLAB. Our mantra is the MATLAB toolboxes are for wusses. And I've got juniors and seniors who write the Rummel-Hart model from scratch in MATLAB. They do the backprop from scratch. They do the training, everything from scratch. And so this thing you've been seeing a lot for the past couple days, there are undergrads learning this stuff right now. And maybe 20 years from now, one of those undergrads will be giving a talk like this for someone, who, maybe Tim Rogers, getting the McClellan Prize in Cognitive Science. Yeah. Another thing. I have a book that came out a few years ago that was going to be titled in a sort of goofy way. I thought it was cutesy. The Probability of Mind was a plan for this title of this book that had a few chapters going under review, lots of anonymous reviewers we got for it. And the reason I called it Probability of Mind is not because it was going to be a Bayesian approach. It was going to be a continuous temporal dynamics approach. But any given time slice in this time course of the continuous dynamics of understanding your stimuli or your world, any given time slice is going to look kind of probabilistic. But that title's kind of goofy and slightly misleading. And one of my anonymous reviewers suggested this title, and I was just blown away. That's a really nice title. I love it. And it's not even my idea. And a couple years after the book came out, I heard through the grapevine and then directly that, as it turns out, that anonymous reviewer was Jay McClellan. He saved my book from having a goofy title. So I'm going to not get to talk through all these things. I will skip big chunks of it. But let me first walk through a cartoonesque version of what might be going on in neural population coding, much less explicit and data inspired as Kriegskort's talk, but a little more easy to visualize for a similar case of language, because obviously we don't have multi-cell recording from monkeys understanding spoken words, but we can borrow a lot of the insights from the temporal dynamics of cell recording data in that research to talk about maybe how spoken word recognition happens when you're looking at what the brain's doing. So if I say to this little kid, his name is Sammy, I say, Sammy, don't touch that candle. The word candle goes into his ears, and you know, if we could imagine what goes on inside that, we could hopefully that primate has a brain inside him. We zoom in on an area that could be useful and interesting. And some of you have seen me do this cutesy thing before. I apologize for you having to live through it yet again. We can pretend we've got a group of a whole bunch of neurons patiently waiting for us to record from them. And you could pretend that only 20 of these neurons, so that we can picture them and visualize them, are the population code for the word candle. Obviously, it's a whole lot more than 20. But I didn't have time to draw that many neurons on this cartoon. But it's not the case that that population code turns on instantly the moment this word is delivered. There's a temporal dynamics to it. And there are other population codes with some partial overlap. This might be the population code for candle. Don't touch that candle. And this might be the population code for candy. And there's some partial overlap. And it unfolds over time as the word candle is delivered to that primate's ears. There's a point in time, just as the word's not quite begun, where you've got a few, you know, cells are randomly firing, and then 100 milliseconds into ka, don't touch that ka, and you start getting some activation that is a little more in that population code, but also in the other population code. I was supposed to use this clicker, and I'm not using it. Sorry. This population code is gradually emerging over time, and about 300 milliseconds into the word, most of candle population code is active and less of candy is. And then finally you get to a point where you've heard enough of the word and you recognize the word fully and you don't feel, you don't have any partial competition with this competitor word like candy or that competitor population code. This is a cartoonesque version of what's going on, but it's not far off what's actually going on, probably. And if you squint just right at this system, you might see some kind of model that involves nodes that are acting a little bit like neurons and have phonetic features and make up phonemes. And you would have the trace model that is a localist attractor network based on interactive activation from early work of McClellan and Rumelhart, and then McClellan and Elman built this thing that takes input features and gets some partial activation of phonemes, and then gets partial activation of some words, and there's feedback that'll get some of those features active that weren't even in the input, and this thing spreads activation all over the place and bounces around. It's essentially a localist attractor network. And if you take the you take that top layer of lexical items and use like a loose choice rule to normalize it, just make them all sum to one and throw in a little bit of a nonlinearity on that thing to essentially turn them into something very roughly approximating the probability of each of those lexical items being what you're hearing at that time slice. This is what you'll get. A curve like this for the word that's being heard, and a curve like this for candy when you're hearing candle. Gets partially active for a while because there's a lot of phonological overlap. And so this is another way to sort of see in a localist version of that network a single node that is acting like a proxy for that population code. And that node rises very gradually over time, just like the population code emerges gradually over time. Now you can study this in real data and not just cartoons. You can have human subjects wear a head-mounted eye tracker and give them real 3D objects in the world or stuff on a computer screen and instructions to pick them up, like pick up the candle. You could also put on little kids, but we don't like to do that too much. It's kind of hard. That's a Photoshop. I didn't really put the eye tracker on Sammy. Okay, and here's the kind of view you have with some of these eye trackers, is a field of view of objects and crosshair superimposing where they could be looking. And the reason to do eye tracking, there's a bunch of them, but one of the main things that attracted Mike Tannenhaus and me when we started doing this head-mounted eye tracking was that cicads are promiscuous. They have a low threshold for execution. You can have some partially active population code or partially active representation, and it will nonetheless cause an eye movement often, even though it's maybe a competing representation, like candy when you're hearing, don't touch that candle. So we had a display like this with real 3D objects. It's not a real raccoon, it's a toy raccoon. But you get an instruction like pick up the candle, and on a lot of these trials, you'll see a saccade to the candy for about 200 milliseconds and a corrective eye movement to the candle. And if you ask the subject, did you notice when I told you to pick up the candle, you looked at the candy, they'll say, no, I didn't. Why would I do that? This is, you know, a couple hundred milliseconds in their life of some, I would argue, some population code getting partially active and then dying out, and they don't even notice it happened, but their eyes reveal that it happened. And a control condition like a pickle, nothing else sounds like candle, you get quick eye movements. This is data from that, where you look at the probability on any given time slice, or the proportion of subjects in trials in which subjects were fixating the target object that's being spoken, candy or candle or tower or towel, etc., and looking at the cohort competitor. So this is the actual data of subjects where their eyes were on these time slices. And you know, as you recall, there's the model and there's the human data. You can also think about this in terms of a saliency map, a little bit like what Kriegscourt was showing is you've got a map of parts of the visual display that are drawing your attention. And at the beginning, these could be cells here that are partially active, cells here that are partially active. Maybe this is parietal cortex or something. And at the beginning, all these objects are equally likely to draw your attention, equally salient. But as that word unfolds, you'll get some of them more active because their names match some of those phonemes. And over time, this continuous temporal dynamics would show you how these things are partially active, drawing your attention and drawing eye movements and drawing your reaching movements. So the poor man's eye tracker is a mouse tracker, which it's cheaper and easier. You can do it at the same time as eye tracking. And in some ways, it's got a few advantages over eye tracking in that you're going to get 50 or 60 samples per second out of this thing. Whereas with the eye tracker, you're going to get about 3 or 4 samples per second at the most, being the fixations that take place. And so if you give someone instruction, click the ladle with a dolphin as a distractor, you'll get a pretty straight, this is an actual set of samples from a mouse tracking. So here's a case of You do have a competitor. This is like the candy candle case. You're told, click the beetle, and there's a beaker out there. And that's an individual trial of a computer mouse movement that curves toward that competitor. The nice thing about these data is that you can look at individual trials and see the graded attraction toward that competitor, as opposed to eye movements, where on any given trial, you either looked at the competitor or you didn't. And so you take, you know, pool the data, and you can find that, like, from the 20th to the 80th time step, you have a greater curvature toward a pickle when told click the picture than if there was a control condition with something that doesn't sound the same. Now, a really nice suggestion was made for how to analyze these data to show the benefits that mouse tracking can give over eye tracking, and that was look at a test for bimodality of these trajectories. So in any given individual trial, is it the case that this thing draws movements that are way over there half the time, and the other half of the trials, it's a nice straight movement? That would be sort of like you totally misinterpret the word and then correct yourself, or you totally heard it perfectly, which would give you, when you average them, give you nice smooth curves, but it wouldn't be a parallel activation kind of story. That suggestion for how to do that bimodality analysis, as it turns out, came directly from Jay McClellan, where we measured the curvature in a few different ways. You can measure how curved these trajectories are, and look for bimodal distribution of that curvature. And in every situation, we see unimodality. So it's from trial to trial to trial. You see graded curvature suggesting this parallel activation. Okay, and there's a pretty picture showing this idea of something like attractor basins in the high billion-dimensional state space. Attractor basins that are trying to get this system to settle into them as the word unfolds. And the mouse track we get is a little bit like, in a slightly but only slightly playful notion, like a dimensionality reduction of that billion dimensional space over time being forced to eke itself out into a two-dimensional action space. And I won't talk about any of these other things in the interest of time, but the big picture story is that we've got a lot of work showing that visual context can tell language what to do, especially spoken word recognition and also some syntax. We can build some localist attractor network models that, again, are inspired by interactive activation to fit those data. And there's also work that I'm not going to talk about showing how the temporal dynamics of visual search reveals that linguistic context can tell vision what to do. So not only do we get to make the psycholinguists mad by telling them they have to care about vision, we get to tell the vision scientists mad, get them mad by telling them they have to care about language. And I'll stop there. Maybe time for a question or two.
Yes.
Paul.
What do you have to say about mental trajectories in your own state space?
Thank you very much. All right. Now, what do I have to say about mental trajectories? It's a shill kind of question. He wants me to be able to show that section of my talk. And I'll pay you the $20 later. So here's a way to think of what's happening in the real physical substrate over time slices. So idealized T1, T2, T3, 4, and I used fMRI colors just to make it kind of familiar. But if you had 12 neurons in your brain, early on in time of hearing, say, the word candle, you got some partial activation, and then over time it spreads to a few areas. There's one population code and there's the other one. They have partial overlap. And both of them are partially active at this point, and then one's a little more active, and finally one totally wins. And that's sort of a cartoon version of close to what's really happening in the physical substrate that we want to study and know what's going on. And, you know, in the neuroscientist's data, the data in his lab are going to look like this, with firing rates doing exactly the same mathematical report of some physical phenomena. And a localist attractor network is going to, you know, pretend to have a single node that can pretend to tell you what's going on for that whole population code, and it'll have one of those nodes rise in activation over time, and the other one rise for a little while and then drop down, and that's sort of like the trace model, doing the same kind of phenomena there, just doing a dimensionality reduction into one node per population code. And in a dynamical systems approach with attractors, like that cutesy pretty picture I showed, this could be a two-dimensional projection of this 12-dimensional space, and what's happening in that two-dimensional space is a trajectory of these activations being locations in that 12-dimensional space that we get to see in two dimensions, and that location changes over time, flirts with two possible attractors, finally settles into one over time. this dynamical systems kind of approach that is actually very compatible with connectionism, they had an arm wrestle for a while years ago, and they're getting friendly again. This dynamical systems approach is not a metaphor, it's not a bunch of buzzwords, this is a mathematical redescription of the physical phenomena, just like these other guys are. And so those are trajectories in mental space that sometimes you can see with mouse tracking and other lots of other methods too, of course.
Gregor wants to say something.
Okay.
This is actually what one would call the potential field approach in robotics.
Yep.
And this is because the relaxation to the attractor is where the action is. So the transient to the attractor is where the action is. Well, I think a dynamic systems account for this would use a different representation, for instance, heading direction, which for instance for these movements would be plausible neural code. And in terms of heading direction, you would actually be sitting in the attractor all the time, an attractor for heading direction, and it would just happen that the attractor moves because the activation patterns are still relaxing.
Yeah, so it's certainly the case that given a constant flow of input, the attractor landscape is, even in what I've described, can't be a static thing. It's got to be changing, fluxing, and that's how you can move. Otherwise, you'd be stuck thinking about Kando for the rest of your life. But we should probably stop. Okay, thank you.